David Lowery is a storyboard artist and illustrator for countless films and series. From Honey, I Shrunk the Kids to The Mandalorian, he is a well-known collaborator of Hollywood's biggest stories. Artists like David are integral for shaping the style and flow for any given film sequence. They can save a production time and money by visualizing complex and imaginative scenes based on the script, director's requests, and even their own ideas. They often do this by producing hundreds, if not thousands, of sketch-like artwork, sometimes depicting nearly every intended shot. David had the unique and wonderful opportunity to work on the original Jurassic Park trilogy. He also did early work on the fourth film that would become Jurassic World. Join me, Derek Davis, as I discuss with David Lowery his time spent on each of these massive productions. How did you become the storyboard artist for Jurassic Park? And at what point in the production did you start?
The first Jurassic Park, I was new to the business in a sense. Before I was working up at ILM, I was doing various things, a couple commercials and some television animation, storyboarding commercials, storyboarding television animation. And just by sort of meeting various people and almost by chance, I heard of a job opening up at ILM. This is around 84. 85, and went up there with my portfolio, and I had some storyboards that I had done for TV that looked filmic. They looked like movie storyboards, you know, and I always tell when I talk to classes, you know, one of my bits of advice is to make sure each frame looks like a movie. You know, it doesn't look like a cartoon, it doesn't look like something other, and you know, and that's by a real, you know, realistic perspective and realistic characters somewhat, and the shading and the kind of lighting that you're attempting to quickly mimic in a storyboard. So the samples I showed got me the job up at ILM, and I was up there for a couple of years, and I left there when Joe Johnston left ILM to direct Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And we stopped in LA on our way down to Mexico City, where we filmed the whole thing. And in LA, I worked with a particular illustrator who was pretty very well renowned as an illustrator, and art director Marty Klein was on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in LA at this office. And we worked there for several weeks. And then we went on our way down to Mexico City and where they filmed it and where I finished storyboarding it. And so I was there on set, so to speak, and in the office right next to the stages, and there for probably 4 or 5 months over the course of not the entire film shoot, but well into the filming. You're there sort of as on a lot of movies, you're there as sort of an insurance policy in case things change and they want to redo storyboards and whatnot. So anyway, so after that, I came back to Los Angeles after Mexico City and didn't go back to ILM, but in LA, I worked on a couple of bigger movies. And then Joe Johnston landed Rocketeer, which was filming at the Disney Studios here in LA. And in that show, he got me as a junior illustrator. And I worked on Rocketeer for a year, pretty much. And the person who I had met along the way, that Marty Klein fellow, was working at Universal on the first Jurassic Park. And so as I was finishing on Rocketeer, Marty Klein called and said, well, we've got 5 illustrators here already, and we want a junior, because juniors work for less money, you know, and you still do the same work in the same long hours and all that, but if you had a number of senior illustrators, you could hire a number of junior illustrators. So as a junior, I went to work on Jurassic Park. And that was my introduction to Steven Spielberg and to the Jurassic films. And I worked with Steven from that point on for, I don't know, probably 6, 7, 8 years, but it all started there. So I was one of five or six guys. I can't remember entirely. And what half of them were doing were set sketches, you know. Photoshop wasn't in use quite yet at all. And computer assisted drafting wasn't really a thing yet either. And so the illustrators would do what they call a projection drawing, which was also kind of how architectural renderings are done to a certain extent. But the thing about a projection drawing is, and it's not terribly complicated, but it's very, very accurate in drawing what the camera is going to see on a set, an interior or an exterior or whatever. You use certain sort of tricks to project from the blueprints. You know, they've drafted up this room or this the big lobby of, you know, where the movie ends with the T-Rex and them fighting. I mean, that kind of, you know, thing is drafted in the traditional way on paper, and you can create a very accurate rendering in perspective based on what a particular lens is going to see. So there was a lot of that being done for the show. And then they present that to the director, and this is what your set's going to look like. And this is with a, you know, 21 millimeter lens back in this corner and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they do drawings and sometimes paintings with that method, with the projection method. And that had been sort of the stock in trade for illustrators in Hollywood for decades. Storyboards before the film school generation, storyboards were used, but not to the extent that the younger directors like Steven and George Lucas and others reintroduced and brought to the forefront storyboarding for their films, which had a lot going on in terms of post-production and stunts and the scope of the film and all that, you know. So storyboarding was getting bigger and bigger throughout the 70s and into the 80s. And, you know, and so myself and two others were doing all the storyboarding on the show. And the thing about a Steven movie is that Steven storyboards it first, really, right? And they carve out time for him to be able to sit and draw his rough thumbnails, you know, and then our job becomes in kind of interpreting and redrawing it as illustrators do, you know, making them prettier drawings. But the bulk of 99% of the shot ideas and the action, the shtick, I mean, it's a lot of it's in the script, of course. It's written as part of the story, all that happens, but the visualizing of it and making those kind of Spielberg moments is all Steven. You know, and he's a genius. He's just, you know, Stan Winston said, it's no coincidence that Steven Spielberg is Steven Spielberg, which kind of doesn't make a lot of sense, but kind of does, you know, on a certain level, you know, and so those were, I mean, for all those years with Steven, those were really great, great meetings or times. It would just be a couple of us in the room with Steven while he was drawing, and you could see him. He was really big on drawing a sequence of drawings, you know, like the same shot going on for A, B, C, D, E, F, you know, that many frames describing the action as it goes, as it happens. And you'd sort of watch it as he was drawing it, and as he was seeing it in his mind's eye, and then and you'd and it would be pretty cool, you know, because there's Steven moments that he's drawing, you know, and then it would get to the end and you'd wait for the kicker and he'd pause and he'd kind of look off and you realize that, you know, at first you're thinking, oh, he already thought this up before. So, you know, that's why it's, you know, coming out so easy. But then you realize he's just making it up as he goes. And then he stops and he would think of the kicker for the end of the shot or the end of the scene. And then he'd draw it and he'd just be, oh, that's so great. Well, that was wonderful. You know, and once in a while you could input an additional shot, or if you had ideas like what comes to mind, not many, because you know, like somebody said, you can suggest stuff to Steven, but chances are he's thought of that already and rejected it, and that's why he's doing what he's doing, you know. so you know, it'd be a very good day indeed if you could you know, outwit Spielberg on how to shoot something. But there were just a couple beats, like I remember in the first Jurassic, in the kitchen scene, the low tracking shot where you're tracking with, I think it was Timmy, the little boy, as he's on all fours slapping along the linoleum, you know, as he goes. And then under that cabinet, you see the raptor's feet crisscrossing their path, you know, and the foot stops and clicks on the linoleum. That was my idea. Now I got one right. And then another one was the great hunter guy who gets killed by the velociraptor,
Robert Muldoon.
Right.
Yeah.
There's this like a boa constrictor or some big snake going along a branch, and you pan with it and you find the raptor's eyeball in the bush. That was my idea.
Nice.
Those are ones that made it in that I recall, but yeah. So I, I know another idea of mine. This is the Muldoon where we're starting to draw the scene, and not that I'm a gun nut or anything, but just on, you know, from the job, I just know. And my dad, you know, was in World War II, and my brother in Vietnam, and so I'm aware of the history of guns and whatnot. And Steven had a skeet shooter, and when it had some beautiful those over and under shotgun, you know, that kind of stuff, and he wanted I think something that the German army uses. It was a semi-automatic kind of machine gun that the army uses, that beefier than the M16, something at FLN or something, or I think. And I suggested, I said, because I knew he knew, you know, guns to that extent too. I said, well, if I were to pick a gun, you know, rather than with a rifle, even a fast shooting rifle, like an army, you know, machine gun or semi-automatic, you've got to hit something with each bullet, or with one of those bullets, you've got, you know, that's a very specific spot on thing. And if those raptors or those other things can move as fast as we're saying they can, that's really hard. You know, it's hard to shoot a moving target, especially when it's, you know, there's three of them and they're all going to come and shred you like a shredded wheat bowl. You know, and so I said I would use an auto loader shotgun, you know, which is it's like the pump shotgun, but you don't have to pump it. It loads automatically in like six or eight rounds. And so two things, you don't have to load it, but it gives that buckshot spray of, you know, of many pellets going out. So you don't have to be, you know, Deadwood Dick and shoot his eyeballs out, you know. You don't need to aim, you just have to point, and you know, and with that many rounds you could cover a lot of area, and assuming you could, you know, you could hit something in full run or in flight or whatever. So the next thing I knew, the character had a had the Terminator style auto loader shotgun. Because these other illustrators that were doing the storyboards as well, they were also very adept at doing the set sketches, you know, those big projection drawings and paintings, and sort of which are sort of the beauty shots. Those are kind of the concept art of the films. I didn't do any of that, but I really grasped onto storyboarding, and I would just draw the hell out of the boards. And so I wasn't exactly drawing like comic books, but I knew I was drawing for the camera, again, you try to make it look like a film. You try to make it realistic. You try to, you're not doing extreme comic book poses and angles and whatnot. You're kind of taking into account that they have to actually do this. You know, they actually have to film this on the day. And as an aside regarding that, what Spielberg is so good at, like somebody described for him, the storyboarding of it is like building a box, right? Where he's seeing the confines of the shot, of the moment, of the scene. But then when he gets to shooting it, when he gets on the set, he sort of takes the box all apart, you know? And when you see him on the set, you know, it still has all the elements that he wanted in that moment, in that scene. But he's able to kind of rearrange it, or he's able to do those very Steven shots that, you know, go from the specific and boom up and show you the whole shot, the whole moment, you know, or opposite, starting wide and coming down to a specific in that moment. And, you know, and he wouldn't, you know, exactly storyboard it like that, but he would end up, you know, discovering things like that when he went to shoot it. I do remember some boards. Tom Cranham did them, and Cranham was wonderful. He was one of the ones who did beautiful set sketches and also could storyboard. But again, all those guys, they really wanted to be painters, you know. They wanted to be like a plein air outdoor, you know, rugged mountain man painting the beautiful stream and all that. Yeah, or doing these set sketches in paint and watercolor or but Cranham was doing a that lobby that with the banner when dinosaurs ruled the earth.
Yeah.
And he was drawing on vellum, and it was huge. I mean, we had those big old drafting tables, right? And he had a just probably 30 by 40 inch piece of paper and vellum, which is like a very, very heavy, toothy tracing paper, right? And the beauty of that, and the reason they used that forever and ever, is that then you could, they didn't have Xeroxes that big, but you could make a blueprint of it, right? For this big, because they had blueprint, you know, machines, and they had black line paper that gave it this beautiful blue black, or sepia, that gave it a sepia tone. But the drawing was done black and white, and he was using charcoal. And to shade it, he was using charcoal dust, which you can still buy, you know, when you use a big paintbrush and you kind of, you know, smooge it, you know, across, you create these, you know, very elegant, it looks like airbrush, you have very elegant grays from black to light gray to whatever, and you can get, you know, lighting effects. And he's using that stuff. And one day he comes in and he almost like fell over. He looks at his drawing table and he's like, ah! and the janitor had come in with a dusting brush.
No. Oh my God.
Took off all the charcoal dust. He almost died.
Blame him. Jeez.
That was one of the funnier mornings.
God, probably not for him.
Yeah, no, yeah. He had to redo it.
Oh, geez. But he had a stern word with the janitor.
Yeah, I felt everybody felt bad for the guy. You know, like, he didn't know. He was just in a hurry. You know, he got the whole studio to clean. He's just coming through.
It's like, I'm just doing my job.
Table's
man.
Dusty. What the heck?
Yeah.
What is all? Thought we vacuumed here.
Messy artist.
Yeah. So this is pretty, I think, well documented in documentaries and whatnot about the making of Jurassic Park. When I got there and we worked on, I believe it was from the galleys of the book in a binder. And we weren't given the whole thing. I think we're allowed to read it once you start on a show. When shows, especially back in the day when they were trying to keep a tight lid on stuff, they wouldn't release an entire script to anybody, you know. And this still goes on to a certain extent where you only, you know, see what you need to see in terms of what the scene is. And with Steven, it's not like you're going to go astray, but just having the, you know, those few pages, because he's drawing it for you, you know, he's showing you what he wants exactly. So it all stays in continuity, you know, because it's all in his mind as he's stepping through it, through the entire story. But I believe, you know, you get to like read the whole thing once when you first get there, and then maybe pages change, or probably not. I mean, books don't change like scripts do, but I'm not sure if we even had a script officially in that first installment. When we started on Jurassic, we worked on it for several months, and then Steven had another show come up. He had, you know, like directors have probably 5 years, 10 years plotted out of what they're going to do next, and after that, and after that, and after that, and you know, and that's all somewhat guesswork in a sense, assuming that, you know, every one of those is going to get green lit or what have you. And so in Steven's case, he had Hook was on his back burner. And at some point after several months on Jurassic, I guess, as I recall, Robin Williams and Dustin Hoffman, I guess, were both suddenly available at the same time. So that became like a go, you know, we got to do that now kind of thing. But so he put a pin in Jurassic at that point. But the early days of it where it was quite interesting, because I remember talking to because I'd worked at ILM very recently, right, and talking to my old boss from up there, and I was describing a shot that Steven wanted to do. I think I had the boards for it, and he looked at it and he says, there's just no way you can do that. There's no physical way to do it, because, you know, the CG animation hadn't been invented yet, right? So with that in mind, that first iteration of Jurassic was going to be using three technologies to portray the dinosaurs, and the first was a huge animatronics, which they ended up doing. In that first iteration, though, they had not only Stan Winston, you know, on board for building these, you know, huge mechanized, you know, realistic things, but they had the guy from the Universal theme park who had done the King Kong ride.
Bob Gurr.
I think so. Yeah, that sounds right. He had, you know, the giant Kong head with the hands and stuff. That was like the highlight of the ride, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And he obviously could build something like that. And so he was involved. And then beyond that, Phil Tippett, who was the motion control animator, stop motion animator extraordinaire, you know, from Star Wars and beyond. And he was going to do the dinosaurs when they were featured head to toe, right? So the close-ups would be a big puppet, mechanized puppet. The head to toe dinosaurs, the full shots, the wide shots of them interacting or whatever would have been stop motion. And there's footage of Tippett's stop motion, go motion tests of raptor animation, run cycles and acting, and they're just beautiful. They're just so beautiful. And then CG, which was in its infancy at that point, was going to be used for the super wide vista shots when the dinosaurs were going to be, you know, very tiny off in the horizon and you couldn't see, you know, the skin texture or the eyeballs or anything, you know, they would be a mile away or whatever. And with those techniques in mind for animating, then you just know that's that was in Steven's mind, in his how-to bank of ideas, that's how he would break it up into what you know, what the shots were going to be based on how it would be created. So that was that was that first iteration, those first several months of Jurassic. And so then I went with Spielberg on to do Hook, storyboarding, and Ed Varreau was also then got promoted up to art director on that show. And I think it was myself and one or two others and some at ILM who boarded the whole thing. And, you know, and that was great. So we after Hook, you know, Steven then goes into, I'm drawing, storyboarding it into shooting time, right? And then somewhere in the middle of the shoot, they let you go because they don't, you know, they've already drawn everything or they've already shot everything and or both. And so I went on to do a couple of shows. I did Basic Instinct and then Alive with Frank Marshall and Frank and Kathy. And then in that time, that's when Steven finished shooting Hook, and then the all the editing and all the visual effects and all of the, you know, all that post work is done in those last months. So he was on Hook, I'm sure, for over a year or more. And then we came back because Jurassic was back up and Steven was up and running on it. He had finished Hook. And Steven's also kind of, you know, notorious for notorious in a good way for, you know, for having, before he's finished with one show, he's got the production designer or another favorite production designer and crew already like way pre prepping the next one, you know? So when he's finishing one, the other one is starting the ball rolling, and they're doing check-ins with Steven to show him this and that and the other and whatever. And so we come back to resume Jurassic. And in that year and a half, the guys at ILM had done two things. I think first was the Abyss and that water snake, you know, on the Abyss, that creature from whatever. I guess it was the Creature from the Deep or something. And then Terminator 2 with the Mercury man, you know, the Mercury textured guy who could assume shapes and morph and all of that. So that ability to make realistic textures on CG animated forms was already cooking at ILM, right? And so there's three, Steve Johnson, Mark DePay, and Stefan Fangmeier, along with, I think Dennis Muren was sort of keeping an eye on them at the time, and they really pushed kicked the can down the road. They knocked the doors off the hinges. They kicked the can so hard. They developed a kind of physics-based skeleton rig for anything. I think they must have done that with the character, with the Mercury Man or whatever, you know. And they applied that to dinosaurs. They built the skeleton. They built the, you know, then it's like doing a sculpture in clay, right? You're building from the skeleton all the innards and all the muscles and the musculature and rigging those points. So you know, how and how far and how much do all of these things move, you know, all the way down to the fingers and the eyeballs and the lungs breathing and the tongue and all of that stuff is rigged and animated in this, you know, in this 3D critter. And then the texturing, which they'd perfected with the T2 guy and the water thing, they were able to you know, paint this CG model with those hides of, I can't remember if they used a combination of elephant and crocodile or something like that, and get that beautiful luminosity. However, they did all of that in Maya and presented Stephen with a few shots of CG dinosaurs, right? We weren't the first to see it. I remember the story was that Stephen was in a screening room at Amblin and Phil Tippett's with him, and I'm sure Rick Carter and other producers and whatnot, effects, the ILM guys who did this, you know, were there showing. They showed him this shot of a T-Rex walking by the camera, all CG, the whole thing was CG. And one of the other things they had to develop, and Dennis Muren told me this, was how to get it off the computer and onto film, you know, that they had to invent that, you know. It was pretty extraordinary, and and they did. And the story goes that this shot, it was just stunning, just gorgeous. It was they went out back. ILM was in San Rafael, and it's kind of like out here in Southern California, you know, it's very kind of grassy, scrubby trees and grasslands and, you know, dry grass and the hills out back of ILM there in Marin. They got on the ground with a you know, pretty good 35mm camera, still camera. And they took a photograph of just the ground and the hills in the background and a tree in the mid ground, a big kind of manzanita tree, which looked, you know, filled the frame very well. And they used that as the background to comp in this T-Rex walking from the middle distance right past camera in this up angle. And you know, and so then you had the lighting on it going from sun to dappled light under the tree back into the sun, and it's breathing and its eyes are blinking and moist and the lungs are, you know, and it's just fully beautifully articulated and walking. It was fantastic. And that sold it, you know, and Stephen said, well, that's what we're doing. We're doing that now, you know, we're gonna do the CG right there. And Tippett turned to him, the story goes, and said to Stephen, I think I just became extinct. Because now they weren't going to do his go motion, stop motion. They had this stunning animation in a computer dinosaur. So in that year and a half off, the whole, I mean, Hollywood changed forever. That just changed everything. That technology so there's, in storyboarding from then on, again, it's Stephen's call, it's his movie and his shot choices. And he knew he was going to incorporate by then the Universal Bob Gurr, did you say his name was? That guy,
yeah.
he was gone. And it was just Stan, and they were developing the mechanism and the you know, the skins based on the designs that ILM was creating of the Raptor and the T-Rex and the Gallimimus and Triceratops, all those beautiful things that were, well, let me backtrack. I think actually Stan had a big part. Him and Crash McCreary did those beautiful drawings. They did they might have reversed engineered it that way, because the sizes of the things they had to build, the Raptors had to be a certain shape in order to accommodate all of the motors and structure of a Raptor head that would open and close and blink and turn and swivel. All that stuff sort of defined the bigness of any of those critters. And so ILM took the cue from Stan's designers in designing those dinosaurs and recreated them in CG to look, you know, pretty much the same. You could have a little wiggle room in the thinness and the sleekness and whatever that wouldn't bump for the audience, you know, going from the puppet to the CG or whatever, it would look pretty flawless. And so as it went forward, Phil Tippett found his niche in the CG world, helping, because he's just one of the, if not the best still, animators out there, right? And so you've got this great technology, but it won't do, you know, won't do shit if you can't animate it. If it looks like, you know, Boris Karloff as Frankenstein, you know, walking down the road or whatever, you know, might as well throw it out. So Tippett and his guys, mostly Tippett though, helped interpolate how to animate the creatures. What is that walk cycle, that run cycle, that, you know, that action that an animal does when it, you know, whatever, stops and looks and sniffs and growls and attacks and all of that. So he became invaluable in that. There was that T-Rex raft scene, and at some point it just went away. Cause it's kind of like, you know, how much food are you going to put in that plate, mister? You know, it's like, you can't eat both, you know, both a giant steak and a half a lasagna. You got to pick one or the other, you know? And so it becomes, kind of a practicality issue and a cost issue. And Favreau had this great liner. He said, all of this stuff is on a cool by cool basis. Right. So you got to weigh the cool factor, you know, sort of like, well, we've got this scene and that's pretty damn cool. Do we really need something that big right there? Let's look around, you know, and see what else, you know what I mean? And play whack-a-mole with the ups and downs and the scale and size and the buildup of the whole.
Well, it makes sense, because I know like several of those sequences were based on parts that were from the novel, you know, like the lagoon and the, you know, Muldoon Jeep versus the Rex that you storyboarded. But in books, yeah, you have a lot more time and no concern of money or time that needs to be right, put in filming it, like you were saying.
It's just ink on a page and very little ink too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the beauty of novels. I think some people kind of forget that, you know, like you can only put in so much into like a 2-hour movie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking of that. I was looking at films out and you look at, you see the runtime and you know, and you're always reminded that, yeah, you're right. This is just barely over 2 hours and you got to tell the whole thing, you know, and imply even deeper stuff, you know, as well. And subplot and all that stuff, subtext. And there's a certain point where on a show where it's like a freight train gathering up steam, you know, speed, you know, more and more coals, more and more storyboards in the hopper, more and more set sketches, more and more locations arrived at, more and more things finalized and decided and getting ready. And then, you know, and then it's full steam ahead. You're going to film this thing. And so the rush to, you know, get it all drawn, and to get it drawn in the order that they're going to film it becomes the priority, because you know, that's your job, is to help them get ready to film this thing. And so you're looking at the first assistant director, the ADs have figured out the schedule of what shoots when and where and with whom, and juggling that around because this actor can, this actor can't, and then this actor will, and then, you know, and all that, all of those considerations, which is just a miracle in itself. I have no idea how they can figure out how to schedule stuff like that. It's just amazing. And then you've got, after all that work, that's, you know, 2 years of prepping and all that stuff, there's still the consideration of how much money this thing is going to cost. And so, well, we can afford, you know, whatever, a 40-day shoot, a 60-day shoot, and that's it, right? So all of that dreaming and all of that stuff has to get done in those days of shooting. And there's the saying that you know, when you start filming a show, this is money already spent, right? Probably spent in the 2 years before, but also spent in the publicity yet to come and all of that stuff, you know, that you're spending, this is the old money. It's probably double this now. You're spending $250,000 a day, every day. That's like, well, back then it was a house. That's like, you're buying a house every day for 45 days, 60 days. You're spending that much money. That's, and that amount of pressure is on the director. Right. And that's why when people look at the storyboards and whatever, and they have never spent a day on set, you know, and say, well, you're directing the movie, I just want to smack them. Directing is the hardest job you can imagine. Imagine that you've got 60 days with $300,000 a day they've already spent. As soon as you step on the set, that money's gone. You've got to deliver day after day after day, and you've got to over deliver, and you've got to know it down 2 weeks from now what it is you're going to have to deliver, and you're going to, and there's 1,000 questions a day from all the departments, everybody below you and everybody above you, all those worries and questions and problems, and you got to think on your feet. Well, we can't do that because that doesn't work now. What are we going to, how are we going to shoot that if the raptor won't, how are we going to do it? Well, it's raining. What are we going to do now? Well, you know, all of those things. And the, you know, there, that job of directing, people end up in the hospital. They end up, you know, out of exhaustion or a nervous breakdown or worse, you know,
I mean, or that hurricane. Job,
no, I mean, physically, the toll it takes on a person, on a director with all that on their head, it kills people, right? And so when people say, oh, you directed a movie with your little drawings, or, there's never been a storyboard artist that has ended up in the hospital after a movie.
Jeez.
Unless
well, it's good to hear.
Unless he got drunk and crashed his car or something stupid. You know? So anyway, that's my... And so my... As a result of that fact, of those things, my favorite time on the show is that first day of shooting. We've been drawing it for a year and a half or whatever, me and five guys and five other guys doing concept art and keyframes and 15 people drafting it all and 150 people building it all and painting it and set decorating it and do all those, you know. It all comes down to that moment in front of the camera, that first shot, right? When it's all there and the actors are in and they're rehearsed and they're pumped and the director knows what that moment has to be and it's action. And then it starts and there's the magic right there.
I love those kind of details because it's like there's people, I mean, everyone else basically has never worked on movies before. They don't know all the little intricacies of like what the director goes through, you know, and that's something that, you know, we can't really know unless someone else is, you know, watching it as it happens like you did, or was involved in the process like you were. So that's, I love those kind of details that no one else would know. You know, it's great. Okay.
There's another another detail. I remember I took my kids to the set and my daughter was interested in stuff, and I introduced her to the set decorator, and I noticed this in before the pandemic. We used to, there was always a big meeting. It was, it'd be about 2 weeks before filming began, and it was the production meeting. And it would be just about everybody, all the department heads, definitely, and their right-hand man or something or two, in a big office. They'd get the biggest office they could, and there'd be 60, 70, 80 people around this table. And the director, you know, would thank everybody and give a let's go get them an attaboy speech to everybody. And then the AD who has scheduled this all, they go, everybody has the script and everybody goes through the script page by page, or they go through the shooting schedule. Sometimes it's the shooting schedule. Generally it's that, I'm sorry, because everybody knows the script because you've been staring at it for a year and a half, you know, so it goes by like day by day, what we're going to shoot this day. We're on the cliff and we're going to do this. Any questions? And it'd be stunts. Are you going to be ready? Lighting, where are you going to put those things? Camera, set deck, actors, this. The actors aren't there. They don't want to know how the sausage is made. You know, I don't even want to know how the sausage is made. It's a stinky business. No, but I've noticed over the years, you know, I look over and the camera guy has his script and the set decorator has her script. And you see, like I put notes in the margins, but mine are related to storyboards, you know, sort of wide shot, close up, and then I'm doodling a stupid cartoon or something, you know, and then there's another note, whatever. Each of those people, the lighting guy, the set decorator, I look and I see the notes they're writing, and they're writing down, and this is those details, right? The set decorator's like, what vintage is this thing? Is this wood? Is this going to be stone table? Is this going to be, you know, what about the carpet? You know, is it worn out? Was the person a smoker? Do we have to age down the room so, you know, it doesn't look like you're walking into a brand new condo in Tarzana, you know? Like it's a movie set. It's supposed to be a story is taking place in there. It's not a model home for sale, you know? I mean, every department has their own worries. Well, not worries, their own job, you know, their own detail. And that, I always found that interesting. I showed my kids that, and you know, that's that guy's job, right? That's the, you know, and that's why there's so many damn people in the credit. It's like, it takes a lot of people to pull it off, because partly because the audiences are so savvy, and you know, a bad sitcom on TV and everybody's clothes look like they just came from, you know, Kmart or something. And there's no, you know, but you go into a movie and I remember seeing a Cold Mountain, the Jude Law movie, an exhibit of the costumes for that movie. And the detail, I mean, this was no Kmart off the rack. So, you know, the detail of the buttons on the back of the dress and the cloth that they would, you know, have somebody weave, because that's the weight of a cloth from the 1860, you know, I mean, they didn't have automatic looms or whatever that made a tight, it was, you know, this, you know, the weight of that whatever it was in the you could start your scene on that button and it wouldn't take you out of the era. It wouldn't take you out of the story, you know, I mean, you know, you couldn't do that. So all those details, I mean, that's why there's so many people in a movie making that world, you know. Sorry, I got off sidetracked.
No, that's great. I mean, it's all those fine details that, you know, fans and even just, you know, average moviegoers can look for. Like, I know there's some people that watched the, you know, movie Titanic and were like, oh, the stars shouldn't be in that, you know, alignment. And I guess they ended up changing it eventually because James Cameron's very particular to accurate too.
I was going to say, he would probably go to the mat with them, but yeah, that's interesting. If he changed it, then they had one. If you can get one up on Cameron, that's like, you should retire after that moment. Because he's such a detail guy. He thinks of everything and covers all his bases. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's like, of all things, the star alignment. Like, really? Come on. But I mean, that's how detailed audiences could be. So it makes sense that, you know, they would, in that case, make the clothing look so, you know, for the period and everything.
I was pretty young, you know, and I was like the junior guy on the team. And so you sort of are a little drawn back and a little less adventurous, you know. And you don't want to be on the set too much because your job is back in the office drawing storyboards. And so when the producers look around and they see you there too often, it's like, and they'll tell you this, you know, it's like, what, you got nothing to do? You know, they understand.
Back to work.
Yeah, they understand when you want to, you know, take a look or whatever. That's all fine, but you can't just hang.
Do you remember ever having pteranodons be involved in the first Jurassic Park, which were in the book, but they never made it into the first movie?
So I think we kind of steered clear of them, because it raises too many questions, you know. You know what I mean? If there's a long range flight, you know, gigantobird, you know, then what's to keep it on the island? What's to say it's not going to head for shore, you know? And then that's a whole nother movie and a whole nother, you know, kettle of fish, bucket of problems to have to deal with that.
Yeah, that makes sense. That does make sense. Because, of course, in the book, they, you know, kind of dealt with that a little bit, but again, in the movie, they have to distill just the essence of, you know, to make the movie that they're trying to make, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it becomes kind of unsettling too, you know, when you think about it. If you got, like, you're having this adventure in this contained world of the island and all of that, and then all of a sudden you're, you know, cannonballing these critters off into the world. You know, it would make me a little stir crazy as an audience member, a little, you know, kind of worried about, wait, I want to see that story. What's that going to be? Holy cow. They're headed for, you know, Mazatlan or whatever, you know. You know, that becomes, like I said, a whole nother thing.
No, totally.
Michael Crichton came through once, visiting Steven, I think, and he was like 7 feet tall, you know. He was this immensely huge guy, very adept at ducking under the doorway. You know, most doorways are, I think, 6'10" or something. I remember that from the set designers. They know all that stuff. How tall is the door? 6'10".
No, right off the bat.
Stairway? Yeah. They've drawn it 50,000 times. So that was kind of cool. He was a daunting fellow. I'm 6'4". And
my God. I'm
thinking, oh my God, this guy's a giant. He could crack me in half. I remember when the movie came out, I think by that time I was on the Pelican Brief in Washington and DC and I flew my dad out to kind of do some sightseeing when I was supposed to be in my hotel room drawing, you know, you're going around. But one evening we went and saw Jurassic because he hadn't seen it. And I've had kids talk to me over there, you know, like the young back, this was a, you know, decade ago or more. When like young PAs or assistants or whatever, one of them said that Jurassic Park was his generation's Star Wars. you know, he was a coming of age, and it was that, you know, that was the movie that made him want to get into making movies, that kind of thing, you know. And so I remember, so my dad and I were walking out of the theater, and they had a big balcony stairway coming down, and there's this kid who might have been that PA who I met 10 years later. This kid was like 10 or something, and he's coming down, and he was so rattled, he's like staggering down the stairs, both hands on the handrail, and his mom's walking with him, and he says to her, he just says out loud, not even to her, just says, "That was so awesome." I just love that moment. Like, there you go. It's movies for you, kid.
That was basically me. So, I mean, maybe it was me. No, but that was my reaction. Although I was also actually, I think, pretty terrified the first time I saw it. Like, just really, like, you know, my parents didn't really want to take me to see it. I could see I was only like 6 or so.
Oh, and, my God.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, I had to see it, and we saw it at a drive-in because Yucca used to have a drive-in.
Oh, right.
And, yeah, which was a fun way to see it. And yeah.
Oh my God, in a car, you must have been terrified.
Oh, yeah, and I had nightmares.
There's a big foot coming down any minute.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was perfect. And
you know, that would have been great to scare you if somebody come up and and like jump up and down on the bumper.
Oh my God. Yeah, they probably should have, but then they probably already noticed I was scared or something. Who knows? But I don't know, for whatever reason, I wanted to watch it again after I first saw it. I was like, hey, like, I know I've been having nightmares from this movie, but I kind of want to see it again. So then I wasn't the same ever since, you know. That was accurate what you said. It basically was my Star Wars too, and for I think a lot of people, you know, from my age group, I think it was kind of their Star Wars.